Find a community that supports your goals, whether that's an online group, a local meetup, or just a few friends who hold you accountable. Surrounding yourself with people who get it can be the boost you need to keep going. The bottom line is, take the first step today. The hardest part of the journey is the beginning, but the longer you wait, the further away your dream stays. So here's your challenge. Choose one action, no matter how small, that moves you closer to your goal, and commit to it today. Because the difference between someday and success isn't luck, talent, or timing. It's taking the first step. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, stop waiting for the right time and take the first bold step toward your dream today. Trust yourself. Embrace the excitement of the unknown and start creating the life you've been dreaming about, because the only thing standing between you and your future is action. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rocket.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
The hunger we have inside for the quest for the truth and knowledge, and that's kind of a big driver that has been pushing me in my life, trying to really understand how things work together and thinking about it in a way that isn't necessarily a conventional path, and being completely open to what calls me.
I'm Suki Wessling of the Babbelry, taking translators to visit our modern Tower of Babel. One of my particular interests is the way the trajectory of our lives can change due to life experiences. Those experiences can be professional or personal, of international importance, or so inconsequential that no one else notices them. Such changes wrought by experiences in the personal sphere are particularly common for women, even those of us who have never sought a traditional feminine role of caregiver. Today's guest is a great example of a woman with a curious mind, following where her experiences led her.
Hi, I'm Nicole Tatro. I'm a neuroscientist, meditation teacher, and a speaker and an author. And I love helping people wire their minds for love and talking about what it is to be a gifted woman and navigating in the world.
How did you get interested in the mind? Do you know where that interest came from and how that led you to be interested in non-neurotypical people?
When I was 18, my mom was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which is a neurodegenerative disease. And I was entering college, and I was in a space where I was trying to decide whether or not to go into neuroscience, medicine. And it wasn't really even neuroscience, it was medicine and writing. Those were kind of my two passions. And when my mom was diagnosed, I had been a runner. So I kind of knew what diet and exercise could do for your mental health. And when we went to see the doctor, I said, is there anything we could do to reverse or kind of, you know, postpone the progression of her disease, you know, through diet and exercise? And he looked at me and he said, nope, there isn't anything you can do. It's neurodegenerative. And being 18 years old and being hopeful, I said, baloney. And I decided that I was going to prove him wrong and get a PhD in neuroscience. And before that, you know, school for me was always challenging and I didn't know why. So I was never formally diagnosed with any learning difference. I was not diagnosed with being gifted until I was 22 and I was in college in an organic chemistry class. But prior to that, I really didn't read a book until I was in high school because I was undiagnosed having dyslexia. And so coming fast forward when I was in college, part of what I wanted to do was sort of neurochemistry, and I wanted to design novel medications. And being in the organic chemistry class, I was tutoring people before the exam. And what happened was I got to the final exam and I had basically not finished it. I ended up getting like a 53 on the exam and I was devastated. The class average happened to be like a 50. So the professor was like, oh, you passed. And I was like, no, something's really wrong. Something's wrong. And I called my mom and I was crying and I wanted to drop out of school. And she said, I think you need to get tested for a learning difference. And then that's what opened the door for me to realize like, oh my gosh, you know, my brain learns differently. I learn differently. And then when I was tested, you know, I had an auditory memory in the 99th percentile, but then my written memory was in 40 percentile. And so that's where the giant discrepancy was.
And so what you found was something that I think a lot of people find in retrospect, which is that a lot of times performance doesn't have anything to do with potential, intellectual potential, that performance is often based on other factors.
Absolutely. When I was at UC Davis, I worked in a laboratory where I was looking at how basically neurons of dopamine and serotonin grew in the eye, where ultimately I wanted to understand how it worked in the brain for Parkinson's, where dopamine cells are affected. And I was in that lab. I actually won an award for being kind of an innovative student. You know, I won the Chancellor's Award my year I graduated with my capability in research. And it's so funny that you say that because my professor at the time, Leo Chalupa, said, Nicole, I don't get it. Why is your GPA what it is? And here you are like a superstar in the lab. And I said, well, I wasn't identified as being dyslexic until 6 months ago. So that's why my GPA sucks. And he said, well, if you want to just come and get a PhD here, you are more than capable. So I think the point you're really making is that what we need is we need mentors and teachers and educators and parents to see the potential beyond what a external measurement of a standard grade is. And when we think about, you know, multiple intelligences, and we think about how people could have specific gifts in areas, that's really where we need to be looking at potentiality and not limit kids, not limit adults. And for me, I think I stumbled upon people who thought outside of the box. I mean, I think in academic science and research, they naturally do. And so I was really gifted with the ability to pursue that.
Can you explain what you learned and where Parkinson's research went after you losing your mom and being a graduate student learning about neurology?
So for my mom, what happened was 5 years later, you know, fast forward, I was in graduate school at UCLA. And, you know, there were scientists literally studying how diet is neuroprotective for Parkinson's disease, how exercise was neuroprotective. And, you know, the concept of practicing and wiring your body and mind to really be in tune and in ways that you can, you know, not necessarily reverse the progression, but you can have these elements in your diet and in the way you move your body that can be neuroprotective. So my mom lived for 23 years with Parkinson's disease. Eventually, you know, the disease does cause global degeneration in areas of the brain. A bigger part really about the relationship that I felt in terms of neurology and what you're talking about is in my mother's case, her Parkinson's was really not the canonical Parkinson's that people have. She had symptoms where she had this akinetic form where you have a delay in movement rather than tremors, which is dyskinesia. And so hers didn't present the same, first and foremost. She also suffered from a lot of anxiety and depression. So there was a lot of mental health in relation to it. And my mother was also a candidate for innovative therapies like deep brain stimulation, having an akinetic form where you put an electrode in the brain and it pulsates in the subthalamic nucleus, which projects to the area for neurons in the frontal cortex to release dopamine. And so basically she had this innovative deep brain stimulation, and that worked for several years. And it allowed us to travel around the world together, to have years of really special moments together. So there was a lot that was at the brink of science that really made a difference. My parents also tried innovative stem cell therapies. And so there was a lot. My dad and mom were willing to try anything and everything. And I think that's what was, we were blessed with the financial resources and with good insurance to be able to do certain things, which is huge. And the biggest thing though was the mental health issues that were related that steered me into the world of understanding my own mental health in relation to the anxieties I suffered with and in depression that I suffered with having a parent with a disease that was neurodegenerative. And so that's what kind of led me to alternative practices and leading me into yoga and meditation, which I find can help in dealing with elements of discovering truth.
Crazy for love. Oh, it's everyone's madness. Love, but we don't.
Nicole Tatro started out her career as a neuroscientist. She was inspired to learn more about the brain by her mother's diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, but she had an instinctual reaction to what was lacking in her mother's treatment. At that time, no typical doctor would have promoted the idea that the progress of a neurodegenerative disease could be slowed by such practical physical remedies such as diet and exercise. Such recommendations, however, are common now for a range of neurological conditions. What changed? In Nicole's case, nothing. When she brought her whole self to the job of understanding the brain, she knew that our physical bodies were not separate from our brains and our spiritual selves were not divorced from our health. In recent years, new research has exploded our models of how the brain works, and Nicole's intuitions have been validated by the numbers.
Love is the antidote.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Suki Wessling of the Babble Reap. I'm speaking with Nicole Tatro about her multifaceted career, starting with neuroscience as applied to education and moving all the way to becoming an expert in meditation. Let's return to Nicole's roots to hear why she felt such a strong calling to unify brain research with spiritual practices developed thousands of years ago.
Growing up, being raised Catholic, I always had a high level of spirituality. Like I had mentioned, I went to an all-girls Catholic school and it was up against the mountains. And so for me, I felt like I could connect to the spirit in the mountains. I could see spirit in nature. And when I went into academic science, I definitely felt that there was a hard divide because scientists are materialist. They want explanation. They want things to be, how do you measure a miracle? How do you measure, you know, an intuitive dream you had? And so, for me, it was almost like I had to have my world crash on me when I was at UCLA. My mom was in the middle stages of having Parkinson's disease. Spencer was 2, and I was diagnosed with cancer myself. And I went in to go see a psychologist, and I was saying, I think I need to drop out. I have no motivation. And you know, I can't connect with my husband intimately. And her response was like, drop out of school, have sex all day, or you could go see a psychiatrist. And it was like, there was no empathy. And I was sort of like, what is happening? And she was saying she thought I had bipolar disorder. And then I went to go see the psychiatrist. And, you know, they did the whole, you know, here I am. I did this whole makeup. And she said, oh, honey, no wonder you're dealing with your own survival and your own life. And you have a son and you're in graduate school and you have a mother. Everything you're experiencing is absolutely normal. I could prescribe you sleeping pills to help you sleep, or I can tell you that you need to start doing yoga. And they had the UCLA mark you know, to start meditation. And I started doing my first body scans and yoga. And that was really my doorway into finding peace and finding that it was going to be okay. And it didn't need to be of the material world to tell me it was going to be okay.
I'm pretty certain, but you can tell me if this is correct, that you come across people who say, oh, I would rather take a pill. Why do you think there is a resistance? And part of it, I think, is a trust in Western medical science that people are brought up being told, here, take a pill for that. And they get better and they think, okay, there's just going to be a pill for this. And something like yoga and meditation is a long-term commitment that doesn't work like a pill. How do you get over that when you talk to people who are resistant, or do you not find that resistance?
I think it's highly individual. And so I think that when people are in extreme circumstances, I think a pill and pharmaceuticals and medications can be a temporary relief. And in some cases, it could be ways to help people to move through anxiety, to move through really challenging times. And so I'm not in opposition to pharmaceuticals at all, in the sense that these have been medicines given to us through almost, you know, a divine gift. Now, when it comes to the practice of yoga and meditation, that's highly individual. And we could get into the idea of it's really alignment and timing. You know, like we are all different trees, and some of us need more sunlight. Some of us need to be in the desert. Some of us need to be in a deep forest. And so it's really, each tree is going to have its own botanical growth and timing. And so the way that I think about it is, at the time I was ready. There was kind of nothing else I could do but surrender and say, okay, I'm going to give yoga a try. And for me, the very first yoga classes that I did were yoga dance classes. And the gift of that was every time I danced, I thought about the gratitude I had to move my body when simultaneously my mother was bound to a wheelchair. And it shifted my perspective of the gift of life, of wherever it was at. And so I do not think less of anybody who has to take a pill or who needs to, or it's a, you know, done in a temporary relief, or even if it's lifetime. I don't have a thyroid gland because I had thyroid cancer and I have to take thyroid medication every single day or else my metabolism doesn't work. So just like that being an organ that needs a little stimulation, some people need a little help, you know, especially if you have ADHD, there could be medicines that can help release the dopamine and help, you know, kickstart your brain. Not in all cases, though. And so it's highly individual.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the most interesting science that has come out that really supports using different modalities in conjunction with the sledgehammer of modern medicine, which is, you know, yeah, if you don't have a thyroid, you need to take those hormones. But at the same time, there's also other things that you can do for long-term health, both physical health and mental health.
When we think about how these ancient practices of meditation have been around for thousands of years, scientifically, we absolutely know there's been over 16,500 papers showing how meditation practices can wire the brain and allow for new neuronal growth, allows for us to have enhancements in the frontal cortex. So you develop a larger mass in the frontal cortex, which allows for emotional regulation, allows for greater intuition, in-tune communication, compassion for others, and it reduces the activity in the amygdala, which is our natural fear state. The way that I feel that these practices really work on the mind is that it shifts us out of the traditional fear state, negativity bias mind state. We are inundated with thousands of negative experiences throughout the day. What we can only do is control how our mind responds to that. We can't stop what's coming at us all the time, but we can make the choice and have the awareness of how we interact with it. Simply enough, we have close to 60,000 thoughts a day. So even that, we can internally begin to shift our awareness about what our thoughts are. If I'm having a negative thought like, oh, you just said something really stupid, I could harp on saying, oh, you keep on, you know, you did that. Or I could say, yeah, or I don't have to engage with that and be like, that was in the past. And so, you know, how do we cull our mind in the idea of rumination? How do we break patterns and habits? And so the only way we can do that is through practicing. When we use these different practices, all we're doing is training our mind to shift into greater awareness and greater compassion for ourselves. That doesn't mean that things aren't going to be hard, that suffering is going to be completely eliminated, but it's really our interaction with that. And so when it comes back to the story of my mother and how I learned these practices could really shift my awareness was that with her, I was so nervous all the time, trying to control the outer world to give her what I thought she needed internally. And what she only wanted was me to be in presence with her and sit with her. And it wasn't until this one time that I was nervously getting food together and she said, come and sit with me. I know it's hard. And that's when getting off the cushion and being in presence with her, that was the meditation. You know, you could sit on your cushion and have 1,000 thoughts and they could all be positive, negative, whatever it is. But it's how are you interacting in a day-to-day life with others and with yourself. And where can you soften and bring in more compassion? Looping in the gut-brain interaction is that when we think about these practices, when we practice in meditation, we're reducing our stress levels. The gut has close to 7 million neurons in it, the size of a cat brain. We have 100 billion neurons in our brain. We have close to 50% of our dopamine is regulated and released out of our gut, 90% of our serotonin, the feel-good chemical, the way we feel connected with each other. So when things are dysregulated, when we're anxious, that dysregulation happens between the gut-brain interaction. When we meditate, when we do these practices, we reduce our anxiety and we allow for the microbiome, we allow for things to work more harmoniously. And when you start to see your body and your cells as something bigger than just you, it's such a beautiful teaching that self-care isn't just for yourself, but it's for the whole.
Neuroscientist Nicole Tatro melds her scientific training with her understanding of traditional modalities. She founded an organization called Beyond the Cell to help incarcerated women heal from trauma and ready themselves to rejoin their communities.
Beyond the Cell was started when we were in the pandemic, and I was awarded from Caltech an alumni award to start a nonprofit, which was the intention to teach neuroscience, meditation, and expressive writing originally, but it turned to be the arts for women who were transitioning out of prison. And it happened during the pandemic where I wasn't able to go into prison. So I worked with girls in a group home. And what I was working with was designing different types of meditations, focusing on how to deal with trauma. Because again, when we're talking about individuals who have been in juvenile hall, they can experience high levels of trauma. So how do you open up to these practices and feel safe? And what I found was often with these young girls, they really appreciated starting with the arts and doing meditative expressiveness through the arts.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you see the future of neuroscience now that someone like you can be saying, yes, it's not incompatible for someone who's a neuroscientist to also be teaching meditation. Where do you think we're going to go from here?
When we think about what we have seen scientifically showing, for example, when people are in spiritual experiences, that you have the parietal lobe being activated, and when people experience oneness, I think that, okay, what's happening in the brain? You're getting brain waves and you're getting energy showing an activation of a conscious awareness of oneness. Does the oneness necessarily need a mind correlate vibrational frequency to be told you that there is oneness? I think for some people, they want that material information. And at the same time, oneness is just there. It's not something you can measure. And so it's experienced. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about these things, and when we think about the potentiality, I mean, the whole point of what a miracle is or what grace is that they aren't things that can necessarily be measured, that they just have to be experienced with faith. Really, wiring our minds for love is moving out of these fear states and moving into these trust states. I mean, fear is a normal part of our life. It's not going to ever not exist. And at the same time, we can have the awareness of how we interact with it. You know, especially being raised in a culture and a world that sells us stuff, sells us everything based on fear of never being enough.
No, we're crazy for love.
Thanks to Nicole Tatro for sharing her life and wisdom with us. You can learn more about her work at awesomeneuroscience.com. Crazy for Love by Carcy Blanton is courtesy of the freemusicarchive.org.
Sadness. Love is the antidote. Love is the antidote.
That's it for Sprouts. I'm Suki Wessling of the Babblery. You can find full episodes at babblery.com. The Babblery is produced with support from KSQD. That's KSQD Community Radio at ksqd.org. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Suki Wessling in beautiful Santa Cruz, California. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprout.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's